Hello and welcome to the Jordan Eat Meterson podcast on Oil Money Wire Plus. Thank you for disconnecting with your children to be here with us. Joining us, Cool Pierre, Canadian politician, an epic politician for men. Such a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about nature and natural hierarchy. So you're a free enterprise politician. So you believe in a natural order of things, you know, like there's a lion in nature. There is so also a CEO, entrepreneur, and so on. And a politician, and within your kind of cosmology, is below that. Is that right?
Yeah, if you're looking at who the true producers are in our society, it's really the businessmen, the entrepreneurs.
Right, not you.
Politicians are more leeching off the public. You know, they're getting in the way, bunging things up with their regulations.
You're a paycheck. Does it come from the free market, from the enterprise system, or?
No, I'm a leech. Leeching off the hard work of people who pay taxes. That's where my paycheck has come from my entire adult life.
Well, that's bloody interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I decided early on in my life that I wasn't cut out to be a businessman, to be a true alpha entrepreneur. And I saw that my place in the ecosystem was more of the leech, more of a subservient role.
So you're not cut out for the free market, or you?
Yeah, if you can't be one of these great men yourself, then I think the only smart thing to do is to serve them.
And this is natural, too. This is something we see in nature.
Yeah, in all levels, in animals, society at large, even in high schools. You know, you have the jocks, the football, the kind of popular kids. And then, you know, my role in that might be more like a water boy, bringing water to the jocks, like serving them, but unable to match their greatness.
Wow, that's bloody, that's beautiful, actually. The when you talk about bringing water, I'm reminded of Matthew 10:42, and this is Jesus talking to his disciples who are going out to cure sickness. He says, if anyone gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones who is my disciples, that person will certainly not lose their reward. And that's what...
Oh, yeah.
That's what you're talking about. Using your weakness for, your smallness for, your you know your bloody place, and you
yeah, exactly. I'm here to serve the elite.
I'm reminded also of this tiny bird that picks the food from between the teeth of the mighty hippopotamus.
Oh yeah.
Annoying little bird, but so important. And welcome back to Seriously Wrong. We are Sean and Aaron, the Wrong Boys, and we're here this week to talk about Pierre Poilievre, leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, appeared on Jordan Peterson's Meatcast on the Daily Wire. It's a meatcast because he eats only meat, and it
right. Yeah, it was like, wait, are you talking meatcast? Like it's like a boys' club or something? Like is this a double entendre? But no, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Eats only beef.
His brain has been slowly withering away over several years of a beef-based diet.
I think it's been close to 7 years that he's only been eating beef, so all the cells in his body have been replaced by beef by this point. I think that's how that works scientifically.
So yeah, we thought we would do this because actually, shout out to former city councilor Gene Swanson, who sent me an email saying this seemed like a good idea for a Seriously Wrong episode. She's a really cool left-wing city councilor here in Vancouver, who I worked on her campaign in 2018 when she was elected. She pitched this episode to us, and we thought it was a good idea.
We like to get into Canadian politics occasionally, and we're also somewhat experts on Jordan Peterson. We read his first book and did a whole Patreon series going over that.
Yeah, we'll link in the description to that. It's a three-part episode, really fun stuff, picking apart his ideas, criticizing them. But, you know, also you got to praise the light no matter the candle. It was a fair-minded critique is what we were attempting to do. And what we've heard from listeners is that we achieved that.
But yeah, this conversation was wild, demoralizing, honestly. It's titled Canada's Next Prime Minister. And, you know, knock on wood, do everything you can to prevent it. But it seems like it's likely going to be the case. And it's not good. It's a dark horizon we're facing.
Yeah, the Conservatives, they've been in the lead for a while, coasting on a wave of like anti-Trudeau sentiment, although Pierre's favorables are actually like minus 18, according to the most recent survey I've seen, like 18% more Canadians dislike him than like him.
Right.
But because the opposition is Trudeau currently, which he's been prime minister for like almost 10 years now or something like that, since 2015.
It's close to 10 yeah. years, yeah.
So there's lots of popular dislike of Trudeau, you know, trucks that say fuck Trudeau on the bumper sticker, flags that say fuck Trudeau and stuff.
Yeah, he's been a popular target of like, obviously the Canadian right, but also like sort of the global right has like taken notice of him. And
yeah.
And I mean, he's also like, don't get me wrong, I don't really like Trudeau for a lot of things. He did some good things, but
like legalized cannabis first before the US got into that on a state by state basis. And
they also passed a federal dental coverage plan under pressure from the NDP. But yeah, households making under like 90K, I think, they're slowly phasing in, letting people access dental care, which is not covered under the Canadian health care before this. So yeah, I don't know, sometime this year, I'm supposed to be able to access dental care, which has been pretty cost prohibitive for me in recent years. So I'm hoping that is fully implemented soon.
Yeah. But then also there's big ticket stuff, like he promised to end first past the post and then didn't do it and sort of scuttled that process, tried to prevent proportional representation, even though that was the consensus of the committee. He bought a pipeline that was being made to like try to end protests and political maneuvering by local governments against this pipeline. So they spent like billions of dollars on this pipeline while hypocritically touting environmental credentials. They did stuff like, yeah, buy a literal bitumen pipeline.
Yeah, they broke a ton of promises related to like indigenous rights, sending lots of weapons to Saudi Arabia. There's lots of things that Trudeau has done that weren't good. Anyway, he's like historically unpopular right now. Even the Liberals are turning on him. And
he's announced he's going to resign following a leadership race as prime minister. He's going to be replaced. And part of the impetus for this is that Pierre is, and the Conservatives are so far in the lead. And there was this recent blow up between him and his finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, she was asked to step aside for a new finance minister. And because she's like a type A politician, like who delusionally believes that she could become prime minister, even though her favorability is also like really low and she's heavily tied to Trudeau, she put out this statement saying that Trudeau was like fiscally incompetent and that they had disagreements over. So it's like basically she made her play, which is like, I'm resigning. You can't fire me. I quit. And I'm putting out this public statement reinforcing right-wing narratives about you as a way to launch my leadership campaign, which is that I'm going to be the fiscally conservative centrist liberal on this leadership campaign, despite the fact I've been your finance minister and the narrative of the right is that we together have spent a zillion billion dollars and we're crazy. So politically speaking, I think it's like, She's doesn't make any sense. And she's going to find out real soon that she's not going to, I just don't see that happening.
Yeah. She's like, I've never heard anyone say anything positive about her, in any context. I don't see that happening, but yeah, Trudeau, we've also had a lot of inflation, like a lot of the world in the past few years and just his administration is over. The NDP is not doing well either. That's our more left-wing party, our social democratic party, and the Conservatives look like they're gonna take it. But yeah, do you wanna listen to some clips?
Yeah, I do. But first, I just want to say something broad about Pierre, which is that I would encourage everyone to look at photos of him when he was first elected under the Harper era, and look at photos of him now, and speculate whether that is what. Say like a 26-year-old turning into a 40-year-old, if it looks like he aged according to the principles of nature, or
Does it look like he aged according to the principles of plastic surgery, Botox, and potentially even human growth hormone?
Look, I don't think getting Botox is wrong. You know, whatever you want to do for your own self is fine, but it's that he has had a glow up. He's had media training. Pierre 2 years ago on the Jordan Peterson podcast, which we also have some clips of, versus Pierre on the Jordan Peterson podcast this week. Completely different people. They're just like, it's like night and day. It's like in the first one, he's giving these long, rambly answers where he's like quoting Rudyard Kipling in order to get an own on Trudeau's father. And in the new one, he's talking about the grandiosity of the common people of Canada.
Yeah. And, you know, my compliments to his team. They've done good work in reining in this creepy, weird little nerd that they have elected leader and turning into someone who's more broadly electable. But I just want to advance the key message for us Canadians as we're going to be having conversations in the coming months. This guy's fake. He's two-faced. He's pretending to be someone he's not. And he's a creepy little weirdo. And like, if you look at the old interviews, look at the old statements and stuff, my advice to the NDP Liberal campaign workers who are listening here in Canada, clip that old shit and point out who he is, because who he is a freaky little weirdo. He's got like Peeping Tom energy. He's got, you cannot trust him to hang. Okay. I just want to make this clear. You can't trust him to hang. He's a freaky little creepy guy. And we'll talk more about this later. And yeah, of course, if I don't have some huge moral issue with people using Botox or whatever, I guess. I mean, I just don't. It doesn't actually matter. But what does matter is that during election campaigns, you need to define the bad guys. And I think an essential part of defining Pierre for Canadians is to point out that he's a fake. He's lying about who he is. The old footage shows who he is. The new footage shows who he thinks he needs to be to impress you. And part of that is a regime of plastic surgery and changing his physical appearance. So it's connected to that. It's not that it's morally wrong in itself for human beings. It's that as a political leader, it reflects something about his fakeness, which then allows us to open up the books on who he really is, which is, for example, the earlier Jordan Peterson interview and stuff and so on. So this will be a recurring theme.
So yeah, when I was listening to this interview, I think I texted you like when I was like 30 minutes into it, and I was just like, Canada is hooped. Like, this guy is going to be the PM. And the reason that I was thinking that was because he actually comes off as like an aggressively normal, reasonable, even kind of charismatic guy. And I was not expecting that. Like, I haven't watched a ton of stuff with him previously, like his old interviews and stuff. I'd seen a little bit and always had like major nerd vibes. But this was like so different. And the way he was talking about workers and jobs and being able to afford a house and like provide for your family. And like,
he uses the word working class even.
Yeah. And like, I was just thinking about, like, I was just home for Christmas and spent some time with aunts and uncles and my parents. And, you know, there's a lot of dislike of Trudeau. I'm from Alberta, so it's very common. And, you know, so they're in the bag for the Conservatives anyway, like a lot of people in that area, that sphere. But, like, I feel like this guy sells to them. And it, like, I was surprised listening to this at how not a online conservative freak he came off as, how charismatic he comes off.
Yeah, no, it's clear watching, like, there's a theory behind what he is saying and not saying. Like, the way that he presents his arguments, he's not just aiming for he sort of claims that he's just aiming for those core conservatives, and that's why everyone's rallying towards him, why young people like him and stuff. But what they are doing something with his messaging that is like triangulation, trying to touch different parts of the electorate's values and experience and stuff, and then tie it up into this coherent narrative of like unleash the market and deregulate things and give out handouts to the rich. Like, that's the policy thread throughout the interview, but it's presented, I think, genuinely in a very approachable way. A lot of work and a lot of thought has went into how he talks about different things. And seeing his transformation from not just a nerd, a mean nerd, a like shitty nerd, is like, that's the archetype that he came off as in the House of Commons before he became leader. And when he was elected, I said, this guy's never going to win. He's too creepy and weird. People are going to reject it. And it's almost as if my mouth to God's ear, the conservative team, read my tweet and said, oh, this guy's right. We got to deal with this creepy weirdo problem. So let's put all of our energy into transforming him and glowing him up into flashy superstar Pierre instead of creepy weirdo Pierre. And they've successfully done that to a great deal, and it's reflected in the polling. But that ideological college conservative internet comment, hyper ideologically motivated freak stuff still exists across this interview. It's an hour and a half long. And there's threads of that that keep coming up. And it really reflects in the way that he speaks, that he's not reasonable.
He tosses a lot of stuff out there that really like shows what's going on beneath.
Yeah. So the seemingly reasonable front facing stuff casts this shadow. I've prepared a little supercut. I think this is the true spirit of the interview. This is the payload that is being wrapped inside a strategically oriented, more accessible argument, this here.
We have a prime minister who is dedicated to a extremely radical ideology, authoritarian socialism, utopian wokeism, wokeism communists, wokeism socialism.
Global utopian delusion. That
these environmental loons that hate our energy sector. Wokeism, dig mines, build pipelines, business centers,
drill
new tech companies, drill, unleash the free enterprise system to make this the best place to get a return on your investment. We have a prime minister who is dedicated to a extremely radical ideology.
Barring catastrophe and God willing, it appears very probable that Pierre Poilievre is Canada's next prime minister.
So yeah, that is the person who, as Jordan Peterson puts it at the beginning of this podcast, barring catastrophe and God willing, is our next prime minister. And yeah, terrifyingly might be right.
Yeah, it looks like it. I mean, that's the payload of a much broader discussion, which is much more approachable. And I think a lot of our boomer parents and stuff are going to be much more likely to be like, no, he's all right, you know?
And I feel like they're taking a shot directly at us with this utopian wokeism thing that came up a few times.
No, that's like my favorite. When I was listening to this interview and they said utopian wokeism, I was like, no. Now we're cooking. Now we're doing this episode for sure. Because that's us, you know, like there are utopian wokists out there, but we are a rare bunch. True, yeah, sincere, yeah, yeah. Sincerely woke, sincerely utopian.
And to Justin Trudeau, neither of those things. Maybe like sincerely half woke in a liberal mainstream way, but he's not a utopian and he's not really woke.
And for us, I mean, what utopian wokeism means, I mean, I would love to wake up tomorrow and all of a sudden Trudeau, Jagmeet, the NDP, the Liberals, the Democrats, all around the world, they become utopian wokeists like us. But to be a utopian wokeist means that you want to create a library society, a global commune of communes where people are paid according to need, where we live within environmental limits and we get all the advantages of limiting our consumption of resources and energy use and all of the benefits of a society of abundance through the dynamics of a library. And at the same time, we work to abolish ableism, racism, transphobia, misogyny, and we create an egalitarian society where all human rights are respected and we can stand side by side in a democratic society and have our values reflected in politics in a meaningful way for everyone, not just now, but for generations. A ecological society, a democratic society that respects everyone, abolishes the legacies of colonialism and racism and the deep-seated misogyny and hatred towards women in our society, among other things.
Yeah, I've never once heard Justin Trudeau or Jagmeet Singh say that they wanted to fundamentally reorganize the Canadian economy along the lines of a lending library to provide everybody with all of their needs while using fewer resources in the process of it. I would love it if they did. That's never been in the NDP platform. Nope. It's never been. So
what type of
stolen valor, honestly, to be calling them utopian wokists.
Yeah, and we're right here. You know, it's like we're going to talk about utopian wokeism. He doesn't mention the Seriously Wrong podcast. Yeah. He's a Canadian.
It's a slap in the face, honestly.
It is a slap in the face. It's offensive. And that's just the type of disrespectful behavior that you can expect from him if he becomes prime minister, to go on Jordan Peterson's show and not shout out the real utopian wokists and point out that they're totally inadequate.
Completely rude. Disgusting.
But I think, the context of that quote, when Pierre first says that, and this is near the beginning of the interview, it might be illustrative if we expand out on what he was saying.
Yeah, I have a bit of a longer clip here, and I think this will show a bit of what I was saying when he seemed like approachable or saying things that I thought would resonate with people.
It's actually the most important question in life. Why? Why are you doing what you're doing? And our answer to that is to bring back the Canadian promise that anyone who works hard gets a great paycheck and a pension that buys them good food and a nice home and a safe neighborhood, that anyone from anywhere can do anything, and that people are in charge of their own lives.
So that's a very local vision in a sense, right? It doesn't have that the grandiosity of an international utopian vision, for example.
Well, maybe
it's very down to earth.
I think people are sick and tired of grandiosity. In fact, I think there's something grand about a family that can go on a nice road trip and share stories and build lasting memories that the kids will remember when they're 85 years old.
Despite
producing
all that nasty carbon dioxide.
That's right. I think those things are grand. And I think with the problem we've had in this country and in all of the countries that have been afflicted by this horrendous utopian wokeism is that it's been focused on the grandiosity of the leadership of the egotistical personalities on top and not the things that are grand and great about the common people.
So yeah, talking about if you work hard, you should get a great paycheck, a pension, you know, be able to go on trips with your family, and the grandiosity of the common people. Like, this is all devoid of context. I'm like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. I do think people should get a great paycheck if they're working hard. I do think people should get everything they need, a pension even.
Yeah, and this Canadian promise thing, I think they made that up. I've never heard that before. It's like a version of the American dream.
Yeah, I Googled it to see. I haven't seen it mentioned anywhere other than Polyev saying it. And John Rust had said it recently.
The local BC
statement.
Conservative.
Yeah, conservatively. So it seems like a recent conservative thing where they're just, the American dream isn't a thing in Canada, so we'll just call it the Canadian promise.
Yeah, I mean, promise is better than dream. I will hand them that. Like, a dream is something that happens when you're sleeping. It's usually weird. And a promise
American dream makes it almost seem like, you know, you can dream of that, but, you know, whether it happens or not, who knows? But the Canadian promise is
you have to be asleep to believe it, is what the George Carlin.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say the same thing about a promise from the Conservative Party of Canada. You have to be asleep to believe it.
Yeah, true.
But also, just pedantically, there's never been any time in history where if you work hard, you are guaranteed a good paycheck and a home, et cetera. Like, how hard you work and how big your paycheck is, there's a loose correlation in certain contexts and certain
fields. No, it's never been that the hardest workers get the highest paychecks.
Yeah, and there's
that's huge, not how our economic system works or has ever worked or is designed to work.
Yeah, and you need to go in like a pericon direction to try to achieve that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which you check out. We did an episode on pericon a couple years back. But like, yeah, and there's also tons of stuff that, you know, this unpaid hard labor that people do, and most saliently, I think, is like the stuff around housework, reproductive labor, things like child rearing, family life and stuff. This is hard work. A single mother with three kids, she's got to work really, really fucking hard to just keep afloat in the context of, I don't know if you've ever been around a toddler, and like the amount of attention that they demand is intense. It's crazy how much they love to be acknowledged and to be responded to and stuff.
They want to talk and interact, and they want your attention.
Yeah. So having three kids like that without someone else, like I mean, this is a cliche to point out, but it's important when we're talking about hard work and like who works hard. If we wanted to make a Canadian promise that hard workers are
guaranteed an amazing paycheck or what would you a great paycheck?
Yeah, something like that. And okay, fine. Well, then, let's talk about it in a real way. And then also we have to acknowledge, where does the majority of money in our existing system come from? Like, how do you make the most money possible? It's through things like stocks, assets, and like millionaire and billionaire shit. Like Jeff Bezos makes, $11,000 a second or whatever. I don't have the actual stat on hand, but roughly something like that.
Yeah. Owning wealth is the number one way to make money, like to already own a bunch of wealth.
Yeah.
The utopian wokeism stuff in that clip is really weird because like he basically says it would be great if you worked hard, you could earn enough money to have a house, good food on the table, pension. And then Jordan Peterson's like, that's really local. That's not like an international utopian wokist what are you even talking about there? Like why?
There's a lot of non sequiturs in this whole, it's like they're playing this game. And I think it's just like Jordan Peterson's brain rattled enough that non sequitur is just part of his life. But Pierre is intentionally using non sequitur for like being like, yeah, no, not some sort of international vision of the planet not burning and people not being exploited
or something.
Is that
the international vision that they're against?
I mean, that's the only thing you could say about that.
It makes sense with Peterson's little snide comment about the carbon dioxide that a road trip emits.
I don't want some grandiose international vision. I want road trips that you can remember when you're 85 years old.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. Like, no one's against that. Like, it's not the position of the liberal government that we need to, like, crack down on family road trips. And even, like, the carbon taxes they've put in place, that's, like, one of his big campaign promises, going to get rid of this carbon tax and make the world affordable. Yeah, I mean, like, the actual stats, like, the actual cost of carbon tax when you're at like 17 cents a liter or whatever, it's like $9 for an entire tank of gas. How many of those do you need on a road trip? 4, 5, 6 maybe. Talking like $60 on the cost of that's not making or breaking a road trip, especially when you consider like, if you're paying $70 to fill a tank of gas, $80 to fill a tank of gas, and you're paying $7-$8 on that. That's not the place. That's not killing road trips, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And it's like he's selling it like, oh, if we axe the carbon tax, people are going to have all this money in their bank account again. And it's like, I mean, even if you fill your tank every week, $80, you get $8 back every week. It's like, it's not that much money to, like, the average person isn't saving that much money on filling their gas tank and not having to pay carbon.
Also, the other thing is like we have a carbon tax and dividend system in Canada. So it's not just the carbon tax. It also comes back in the form of a rebate.
Right.
BC is a little bit different where we live than most of the country, like how much you get back and stuff. I think it's like income tied here and not income tied elsewhere. But the basic, like the carbon tax is taken on gasoline and other places across the whole year. And then you get like 4 checks over the year, 3 checks. I think it's 4 checks for like, $180 here, $200 there, or whatever it is. And if you add up, according to the parliamentary budget officer, who is like the economics fact checker of the Canadian Parliament, who is a nonpartisan economic fact checker, 80% of Canadians get more in rebate than they pay in carbon tax. So Pierre's policy is to tax
80% of Canadians for the benefit of 20% who use a lot of carbon.
Exactly.
Right. So sneaky. That is so sneaky to be framing this like, oh, you're going to save all this money. And then, not mentioning that carbon taxes fund dividends that like most that people get back. Yeah.
And I calculated for my we drive my toddler to daycare every day. So it's like we've been driving the most that we've ever driven. This is like the most high carbon year of my life.
Right.
Still, the gap between what we got back and the gap between what we get back and what we're actually paying was like enormous. It's like $500 or something we get right. for free from this program.
I fill my car's tank like once every 2 to 3 months, maybe for like $50. So I pay very little.
Before I had a toddler, that's where I was. Yeah. So yeah. It's like, you get $700, $800 or something, you know?
Yeah. And then, he ends this off with a shot at Trudeau with the grandiosity of the leaders. Like there's this narrative that Justin Trudeau is like a narcissistic person. I think he probably is. I don't know. I don't know enough about Trudeau, but
politicians.
Yeah, exactly. Polyev is also a narcissistic person, but like saying like that's what they're about, but we're about the grandiosity of the common people that we want to make pay more by removing these carbon tax rebates and the I have a second clip that I want to play related to this first one because I feel like it kind of gives the game away on like what they mean by some of these things they're saying.
Yeah, and can I just say quickly before we roll this clip, he's contradicting himself. He's saying, I'm just going to debate club him for a second. He's saying that people are sick and tired of grandiosity, but he's interested in a specific type of grandiosity, which is the grandiosity of common people, the grandiosity of road trips that you remember for decades. That is, sir, grandiosity, which you have said that you were opposed not less than a minute ago. So please rectify. But yeah, I don't know. It's just something I noticed. It's all just non sequiturs. There's all this, like, let's talk about road trips for a second. What the fuck are you talking about? What road trip policy has ever been introduced in the entire history of humanity?
When I meet young people today, they are exhausted. They have bags under their eyes and all they do is work. And the worst part about it is not that they're working all the time. It's that they don't see a light the end of the tunnel.
Well, that's a genuine breakdown of the social contract, right? Because Absolutely. The deal, like you said, the deal was supposed to be, if you do things right, you'll be rewarded.
Yes.
And there isn't anything that defines hopelessness more clearly than seeing that if you do all the right things, the pathway is paved to failure.
Right.
Right. So that's so demoralizing. And, you know, what's even worse about that is that the people who are most demoralized by that are precisely the people who would be most productive and hardworking. Because the ones that are sponging along, they don't give a damn anyways, right? They're not losing any glorious future and they're not sacrificing for it anyways. But it's really not good when your economy is set up to punish people who are entrepreneurial and hardworking.
And that's what it does now.
So, it's mostly Peterson talking, but, you know, Polyev is in there being like, yes, and that's what our economy does right now. And the going from the grandiosity of the common people to what we want to change about our economy is that our economy is set up to punish the entrepreneurial people, the hardworking people. And you have to remember, hardworking for conservatives is not referring to people who are actually working hard. It's referring to people who make a lot of money. Because when they're saying the economy is set up to punish people who make a lot of money, they're just talking about like policies that are against the business interests of oil and gas industry or the development industry. Like this framing of these, like, you know, initially we're talking about the common people as like these grandiose people, this great who want to work hard and do things. And then suddenly they're sponges who like they aren't sacrificing anyway and they're not trying that hard anyway. They're like, what do we think about like a common worker here? Like, how are you making these distinctions? How do you know who's the sponge who doesn't deserve to get anything back because they're not sacrificing for it anyway? And who's the hardworking entrepreneurial people? And it ends up being like tax cuts for the rich, basically.
Yeah, it's like they're drawing this like almost workerist distinction between, say, the hard workers and then the beneficial recipients of government programs. So that would be people who are disabled, people who are low-income families, people who are out of work or unable to work, and seniors. Those are the main beneficiaries of social programs in Canada. And they're arguing that the system right now, they like the system because they don't want to work and they're lazy pieces of shit. And they're not common people. They're not grandiose. Yeah.
I took this even as like people who are just like working a low level job, but not trying to advance in it. They might be employed and not on a social program, but they're just, you know, doing the bare minimum, some minimum wage job. They're not trying to become a manager or advance at all. They're just, you know, sponging along, doing the bare minimum. They don't have that entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah, and the premise that like people feel that if they do all the right things, like what you're supposed to do in society, the path is paved to failure. You can't actually achieve what you want to achieve. Like that is the that's true. The carrot. Yeah, that's the it's common sense. Like people do feel that way. People do feel trapped in their lives. They do feel like they're waking up every day. Like when I wake up in a 9-to-5 job, that day seems okay. That week seems okay. But the knowledge that it extends infinitely into the future makes me physically, in my body, I can just feel this horror.
Yeah.
And that it is true also that even if you save a huge amount of your paycheck, you pay the absolute minimum rent that is possible, you get extremely lucky, you pay the minimum phone bill on the shitty carrier that cuts out all the time, you cut corners and groceries and stuff, all of that. Even if you do all of that, there's no chance you can have a down payment on a house. There's no chance that you can have the standard of living that your parents had. That is a true and real experience that they're connecting with.
Yeah.
But what he's advocating is to hand over society in every way to the rich in response to that, to cut social programs, to make it so that seniors who are now getting dental care because of the NDP liberal agreement to that effect are going to lose that dental care because the dentists are so entrepreneurial, they deserve to not just be 100,000-aires, but multi-millionaires. And like, you can,
it comes in like, they talk about housing programs in other parts of this interview. I don't have the clip of it, but like, you know, they're talking a lot about how the housing market in Canada is fucked, and it is fucked, and it's more expensive than like most places in the world. I think they said it was twice as expensive as America on average. And they're talking about how average people can't afford a house, how he's talking to young people at all these events he's going to, and their number one thing, I can't afford a house. So like, that's connecting to the real problem. That's the thing that I think will land for people. Everyone in Canada is going to agree, housing prices are out of control. And then when you get to what he wants to do about it is like, is he talking about subsidizing affordable housing? Is he talking about social housing programs?
What,
is
for the sponges?
Right. Well, like, how else are you going to, like, for the people for whom housing is unaffordable, what are you going to do for that? And like, his policy proposals are, number one, he's going to get rid of GST on buying new houses, which is like, sure, okay, it's like a 5% tax on buying a new house. Like, I guess that'll help a little bit for the people who can already afford it. It'll make it slightly more affordable for them.
Yeah, so it's going to be $1 million instead of $1,050,000.
Yeah,
which is on a mortgage is going to mean that your mortgage payments on average are going to be like $20 less cheaper. A month.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's nothing. And then the other policy proposal
just to clarify as well, at great cost to society, because the revenue of when you have an overinflated housing market like we have, governments, both provincial and federal, they rely like a huge part of the budgets. What's incentivized this unvirtuous cycle in the housing market is that governments who want money to spend on things and they want to balance their budgets and so on, the property transfer money, the things like GST, property transfer taxes and stuff, that is a huge source of revenue for both provincial and federal
governments.
And they're
talking about what a huge problem the deficit is and that the government spending is out of control. But of course, like, they have all these policy proposals that are going to increase the deficit by removing income streams that the government relies on. And then, of course, that's where you get to cutting social programs.
Yeah, and then they're going to say, oh, well, it's Trudeau's fault because he spent so much money. Now we have to clean up the mess. So now we've got an even bigger deficit. We have even less social programs. But at least the guy who's buying his third house just saved $50,000 over 40 years.
Yeah. And like, if you're targeting home buyers in a market like this, you're already targeting people who are in the upper echelon of being able to afford housing. If you can afford to buy a house at all, there's so many people who can't. And like, the other policy proposal that he's talking about for this is, it's kind of vague because a lot of housing policy is municipal and provincial level and not federal. But he says he's going to put pressure on municipal governments to basically get out of developers' way. So, yeah, you know,
right-wing NIMBYism.
Yeah. What that ends up meaning is like reducing the amount of taxes that cities can take in to entice developers to build more, removing requirements for affordable units in buildings, and like all these things that NIMBYs say is going to eventually make the housing market cheaper by allowing developers to build a bunch of luxury units for millionaires, and then it'll trickle down or whatever. We just did an episode about the housing crisis. We did multiple of them, actually. But if you want to get the arguments for why getting out of developers' way isn't the way to make housing more affordable for people, you can check out our recent episode with Kate Willett and
the tenant
union one with Tracy Rosenthal and
Leo Vilchis. And yeah, I mean, this is the overall, like the overarching, he's got all these little small arguments, but the overarching narrative is get out of the market's way, hyperpower capitalism. And if we hyperpower capitalism, we'll have abundance for everyone. But, you know, implicitly, he even acknowledges that there's like a transitionary period, that it's going to be hard at first. We're going to cut social programs, but we're going to unleash the market by deregulating, cutting taxes, and so on. And also what this means too, at the, like say the municipal level, if you say that municipalities can't raise money for their budgets through development, which is a great part of civic revenues currently, then either they need to cut programs that exist significantly, or they need to raise property taxes on homeowners.
Yeah, which is the other major way cities make money.
So his grandiose utopian vision, when it is at the federal level, is brought to the local level, people are going to feel the pinch across multiple layers here. And also as sponges, like Aaron and I are sponges. We love to just sponge along. We have no entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah. Well, that's not true. We're podcasting entrepreneurs.
Yeah, no, I was being ironic. Also, honestly, I'm one of the hardest working people I know. It's incredible, actually, all the work I do between the kid and the activism and the podcast.
That's
true. Pity me.
Yeah.
I should be paid a good paycheck, and I should get to live in a safe neighborhood with a house. Yeah, that's the safe neighborhood.
Safe neighborhood is a phrase I think he said five times maybe, and this is definitely something they're hammering on, safe neighborhoods. There's another clip here I want to play that I think is funny and interesting in a way that it starts off in a way that feels very media trained and a message that a politician want to put out, and then kind of evolves after that into more of his little obsessions and stuff.
Roll the weird ass clip.
My rallies were overwhelmingly populated with youth, which is not normal for conservatives.
Right, right.
And the reason is because in your youth, of course, you as you write it, young people want to have the adventure of their lives. Mm. They want to go into the wilderness and earn a living and bring it home and
do something
raise kids
responsible and
have a purpose that's bigger than just short-termism. And I think, you know, 20 years ago, the socialists would go to university campuses and say, vote for us and we'll let you be a kid forever. We'll give you free stuff and you'll never have to get a job. And that was very temporarily popular across the Western world. But then young people woke up and found out this was not a utopia. It was a total dystopia. And that all the things that they really valued and wanted for their lives were impossible when they were being borne down upon by this massive state. They've learned that help is the sunny side of control.
So yeah, there's a lot there, but that's, it starts off with this like, yeah, very Petersonian, like young people want to have the adventure of their lives. Very true. I think that's something a lot of young people can relate to, like in a way.
It's a way to describe the feeling of like having your life ahead of you and wanting to have a variety of experience.
Yeah, you've just
turned 18.
It's
a way of describing anything, really.
You're becoming an adult. And
so
you're
nebulous.
Just like, I want to go out and have a life.
Who doesn't want to have the adventure of their lives?
I guess I mean, I'm 37 now, and I still want to have the adventure of my life.
Yeah, you have to be like pretty old to be like, I've already had the adventure of my life.
Yeah.
And I've met people like that. My 100-year-old plus great-grandmother who recently passed away, rest in peace. She told me when she was 99, she's like, my hands don't work well enough anymore. I want to die. And I was like, oh, grandma, I'll see you next year. And she's like, hopefully not. And then she lived for like six more years after that. But sorry.
Jesus.
She didn't want she didn't have the adventure of her life ahead of her anymore.
Yeah, it's a thing that sounds good, like, want to have the adventure of our lives. But, like, almost immediately he starts to falter a little bit with, like, he's like, you know, go out into the wilderness, and already starting to lose me. Like, that's not really the adventure I'm into.
Yeah, I mean, camping's fun. But,
like, I get it, like, metaphorically going out into the wilderness or something. And yeah, camping's fine. He's like, but then he's like, starts to say, and bring back something for your, and Peterson cuts in with, do something responsible. Like, you're getting far from the vision of young people at this point who are like, oh, I want to go out there and do something responsible.
I'm 18. I need to go out into the wilderness, raise some kids, and be responsible.
Yeah, like, yeah, most people who want to have a family don't want to do it in the wilderness. They actually want to do it in, like, a home.
And it's two opposite things. It's like they're treating two opposite things. It's actually like a tension that exists within people. And they're speaking to both sides of this tension as if it's one coherent whole, which is that young people, they want to go be irresponsible. Like, that's what it means to have the adventure of your, like, when he says have the adventure of your life, and it registers for me as having some salience to the human experience.
Yeah, it's like taking risks. It's like, doing, like, some crazy shit.
But they treat, like, I'm going to go sow my wild oats and raise a family. It's like, no, that's not your wild oats.
Yeah, it's the tension of, like, a lot of, like, young conservative stuff of, like, trying to make traditional values hip or whatever. And, like, if you want to raise a family, and, like, obviously it's a wonderful thing to do. But, like, the idea that this is, like, some hip new thing that the kids, they want to go out there, it's squaring that weird circle is a thing conservatives try to do a lot of the time.
Yeah, another example of that kind of weird squaring the circle thing is, like, where you have typically, like, say, conservative men, but more specifically, like, misogynistic men who they both want to, like, be wild in the sense of, like, they want to have sex with lots of people, they want to sleep with a bunch of women and, like, party and stuff when they're young, but then also at the end of that, they want to settle down with a 17-year-old virgin bride, kind of, like, there's these two.
Yeah, I'm 45 now. It's time for me to find my 17-year-old. Yeah, the red pill, like, weird ideology.
Yeah, it's like some people try to make it all work together. Maybe it's often two different conservative strains of, like, but there is this, like, paradox in it. It's interesting about this quote is, like, it was almost like a neurotic eruption of these different strains of thoughts on adventure versus settling down, responsibility versus wild oats, where it just kind of, like, bubbled to the surface.
Yeah, he, like, started in one direction and then, like, realized partway through that, like, it wasn't going to land with what he wanted to say. So they had to quickly, like, change course and, like, go out in the wilderness and be responsible.
I think this is a revealing moment about the nature of right populism. Like, the unconscious bubbled to the surface through the contradiction that they're holding together on who they are and what they're doing and what it all means. They just couldn't help it. They were trying to make something that made sense. So it reminds me, I've got this concept floating in my head. I wasn't able to, like, pin down where it came from. So audience, please do fill us in the comments. The concept of fascism as a rebellion or revolution in favor of the system is, like, there's this kind of squaring the circle in hard conservative politics where it's rebellious, but at the same time, it's rebellious in favor of amplifying what exists rather than rebellious against what exists.
Yeah, or, like, returning to an idea of a previous thing that existed, like, basically rolling back certain types of progress. Yeah, the contradiction, like, it does run deep, I think, in terms of conservatism fundamentally being an ideology that is in favor of benefiting existing power structures, benefiting the wealthy at the expense of common people, but trying to frame it in a way that it should be attractive to common people because otherwise they're not going to vote for it. So you have a fundamental fissure there always that you have to paper over in various ways. And this was just a pretty bad attempt at papering over the fissure.
Yeah, and it's hypocritical in the original sense. It's this mask-wearing, lying, deceptive, fake virtue. They're trying to hide behind the fake virtue of going exploring the world and being free when you're young. But behind it is the same old, you know, rigid conservatism of yesteryear where you are a slave to systems and where you are subordinated to systems of structure and authority and so on.
And then Polyev moves into this weird rant about socialists and, like, I love the idea that socialism is like this Peter Pan promise that you can be a kid forever.
No one ever
I actually, like,
me
kind
on
of
that.
Genuinely like it in a way. Like, I don't you know, everyone has to like grow up and be responsible in various ways.
Not all of us can afford the Botox that some of us can. Speaking of being a kid forever, did you get eyelid reduction surgery?
Yeah, what happened to aging with grace, Pierre? But
Pierre Pan wants to be a kid forever.
But then he starts going into like, you know, you can be a kid forever because you'll get everything for free and
You don't need a job.
You don't need a job.
Unfortunately, my experience with socialists writ large, unfortunately, is that a lot of them actually do tell me I need to get a job, which I find annoying because I want to have no job forever and be a child forever and get free stuff. And that's closer to my politics.
Yeah.
But their politics is more like the dignity of that work, et cetera.
The working class and like,
oh my God, what a
bore.
Working
class.
No, I'm just kidding. Well, I'm actually kind of half kidding because the workerist strain of socialism is a dominant one. And it's actually very similar to some of the ideas that they express in this interview about kind of the dignity of hard work and doing everything right, et cetera. And there's tension with a strain of not even like a libertine kind of politics that's more like going into the wilderness, sowing your wild oats kind of stuff. That says things like basic income and stuff like that to make sure that when people aren't working, it's okay. And like destigmatizing the idea of not working, destigmatizing the idea of not being able to work, et cetera. But there's tensions there within.
There's this journey where he's like talking about the adventure of your life. And to me, what that means is like, okay, we got to support kids to be able to go have the adventure of your life. So you're not stuck in this dead end 9-to-5 job immediately because you're struggling to make ends meet. And like the dream when I was in my early 20s and wanting to have the adventure of my life, the thing that I felt was holding me back the most was the fact that there was no social safety net and that you need to work to survive in this current society. So like he went from this tapping into the feeling of wanting the adventure of your life to very quickly saying it's bad when people get free stuff. And in fact, help is the sunny side of
control. It's a total, it pretends to be a utopia, but it's in fact a total dystopia.
Yeah.
The way
punchy on the dystopia.
It's a total dystopia. And no, I think the sunny side of control thing is really
like
revealing.
He's arguing against helping people. Helping people is bad. It is
That's
the same as controlling people.
Help is the sunny side of control is another way of saying that like any attempt at help has this veiled secondary aspect, which is an attempt to control. So help itself is suspect because it's inherently tied to the second thing. And so he's talking maybe specifically about big government Trudeau kind of shit, but the broader principle of help is the sunny side of control is a crazy dystopian.
Yeah, like he just rattled that off. Like you knew that was like a phrase he's had in his head for a really long time. I assume it's a quote from someone or it's a truism in certain conservative circles or something. But it's also like, very anti-Christian in a way, like anti-charity, anti-like, because usually when the conservatives are talking about help, they'll just say, and you know, he would probably say this only applies to government help, but he didn't say government help is the sunny side of control. He said help is the sunny side of control. It's an argument against helping people in general. Like it's
And even just taking the premise seriously for a second and arguing against it as a serious proposal being put forward, it's also the case when we're talking about governments that the absence of help is also a side of control. Because when you withdraw social programs, when you withdraw things that support people, when you withdraw welfare benefits, disability benefits, seniors benefits,
it's harder to have the adventure of your life because you're under the thumb of your boss, the control of your boss.
Anyone who's currently getting help who then loses that help, they are controlled by the circumstances in that they need income. They need to afford housing. As he acknowledges, the cost of housing is expensive. There's all these different... So pulling back help is also it's the shady side of control.
Yeah.
Another tension here between different things he says, like some of the contradictions that are emerging across the overall interview here, is he talks earlier, and it's one of his more compelling moments where he's speaking to people's experience. Young people work so much, is what he's saying. Mm-hmm. All the kids I talk to, they're working all the time just to make ends meet. So basically, you know, they need to be compensated better, maybe implied a better work-life balance is needed. The economy is not working for people is what he's saying, which
is... Jordan Peterson mentions how when he went to university, he was able to pay for his entire year's tuition and year's rent by just working in the summer.
Yeah, for like, he said 4 months covered all year's rent.
Yeah, and Polyev is saying like, yeah, no, these kids I talk to have to work 20, 30 hours a week while doing a full course load. And yeah, that should change. Yeah. But like,
but that's the adventure of their lives. That's what they want. They're in the wilderness being responsible. Like,
but like he would be against making tuition free. He would be against stipends for kids going to college to, you know, help tide them over during
this. Yeah, those little sponges.
The only thing that he would propose in favor of this is, you know, cutting all social programs so that in theory lowers taxes, which means that businesses will pay less taxes. And hopefully they'll just pay all that money right to those college kids so they only have to work in the summer now. Because the businesses will save so much money on taxes from these social programs that we're cutting that they'll just be like, hey, employees, do you want quadruple the amount of money that you're currently getting? And they'll be like, yes. And then
yeah. Also, these anecdotes of like when Jordan Peterson was working a summer job, that was like the golden age of social programs in Canada. Up until in the 90s, there was kind of like this neoliberal turn where there was like decreasing public services across the board. But like in the 50s, 60s, 70s, you had more generous welfare benefits that were easier to get. You had more generous unemployment insurance that was easier to get. You had what was called the universal family allowance, which is that anyone who had kids would get free money from the government. They later changed that to a means tested like tax
rebate.
Exactly. Yeah. During this kind of neoliberal switch, there was investment in public housing. So they were building public and social housing in every city across Canada, across the 50s, 60s, and 70s, petering off in the 80s, and then kind of coming to a halt in the 90s. So that investment in housing meant that the cost of living was cheaper across the board because private sector housing had to compete with this public sector housing that was available. And there was a higher marginal income tax rate at the time. So the people who were wealthiest would pay a higher amount of tax back then than they do now.
Typical conservative living off the benefits of the social welfare state to argue against it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, there's a weird paradox of like, oh, back in the day, everything was so great. And then, like, the details of the actual political situation back in the day was that there was large amounts of federal investment in welfare, public housing, and higher taxes.
Right.
But like that goes, like what they remember, well, we burned a lot of carbon. It was great.
It's beautiful clouds puffing out of the tailpipe.
But yeah, even Pierre, like in the 80s, you just have much better. You have all these different layers of social programs that are better up until the 90s,
when
they started like reining in budgets, cutting transfers, switching to tax credits over handouts, cracking down on quote-unquote welfare fraud, which is imposing these means testing benefits that are control. So actually, that's an important thing to point out too. It's like help, sure. Okay, help is a sunny side of control. Sure. What is the most controlling way to help someone? The way that neoliberalism reconfigured the welfare services to peek into every aspect of people's lives in order for them to get benefits.
Yeah, we have to create all this administrative burden in order to like decide who deserves and who doesn't deserve, rather than just using all that money to directly give back to the common people or whatever. Like you can say help is the sunny side of control, but like you can control less and help more by not doing means testing.
Yeah, yeah. If we accept the premise and say, okay, help is always tied to control to some degree, then there's still more or less controlling ways to help people. And they're advocating for increasing the amount of control
just because it decreases help. And then like saying that that will somehow decrease control. But like, yeah, because in this instance, like the more you increase the control, you decrease the help. They're like directly tied. That's what means testing is, increasing control and decreasing help.
Yeah. And that is the trajectory that is inherent to the program of Pierre. Like that is his dream for welfare is to make it more controlling and less helping. And his justification for that is that help is control.
Yeah. Incoherent.
Yeah. Incoherent. At best. That's the nicest thing you can say about it. It's incoherent.
I'm a nice guy.
It's the product of an addled brain. That's the sweetest, most positive thing you can say about this kind of thing. But yeah, someone came up to me and pitched me on being a kid forever and never having a job and getting free stuff. I would have some critical questions to be sure, but if they could really guarantee it, sounds pretty good. I mean, who wants to get old?
My first question would be, how does the free stuff actually halt the aging process? Because my understanding is that it doesn't, and that when governments give free stuff, quote unquote, like when there are social programs, the aging process continues as normal. But if he's figured out a way how to tie those two together, I'm all in. I love it. I want it.
Yeah, sadly, I have to say, I think Pierre, he just wants staying a kid forever only for the rich. Yeah. And that's often the case with these fake populist pieces of shit. Botox for their well-connected friends, but the rest of us have to age with dignity.
Blood infusions from the young and yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not saying Polyev has had that. It's just a rich person thing I've heard of.
I am saying he's had that just on intuition. I also think he had jaw expansion. Compare, like, look at the old pictures of him. I don't know what surgery it is, but they put stuff in your, like, jaw to have a more square jaw.
I think also losing weight while taking testosterone can change the shape of your face a little bit like that, too. So there's potential there.
Look, I don't know what specific work he got done, but we know for sure they've treated him like an old car, and they've been opening him up and switching out parts for a couple years now. Or they replaced him with a body double to implement their secret woke agenda on behalf of Schwab and the World Trade Organization.
He'd be doing too good of an acting job because you still see the old Pierre coming out in new Pierre. So I believe it's the same person. I'm against body double theory. But,
or he may have been brainwashed. And those moments are the true Pierre calling to get out, but the outward facing... I guess my point is you don't know when someone changes so much and they're misrepresenting who they are. You don't know. Is he going to cut the carbon tax, you know, or is he going to double it? Is he working for is he a puppet of the global elite?
The way he explains it, he's dreamed of being a stooge for the global elite since he was a child. And I think when he became the leader of the party, they were like, okay, you got to step up. We got to give you the glow up, and whether that means injecting or surgery, we'll let your team figure that out. But we want to shape you into the person who can do this for us.
Because you're not that now.
Yeah,
you're
like right now, you're...
You are like a young conservative.
Right now, we love you because you have all these ideas about how great we are. But in terms of selling this, being a salesman to the public...
Yeah, the average person is going to look down on you. They're going to hate you.
Yeah.
They can tell that you've dreamed of being a politician since you were 15 years old, that it was a sick way of getting power over your poor old mother. This all just drips out of your behavior, the way you talk, the way you act, the quotes that you choose, even the shape of your glasses. It just screams bad nerd. And we're going to fix that. We're going to get you under the knife immediately.
Okay, so what are you going to do when you take office? Like, what could Canadians watch you do in the first months of your administration that would help reassure them that this is going to happen?
This is real. Well, first of all, I'm going to axe the carbon tax. It's been kind of an epic commitment that I've made. It's iconic. And so I have to follow through on it immediately. And that will signal to the country that I'm serious. Second, we want to get rid of the GST on new homes and pass changes that aggressively incentivize municipalities to get the building started. That has to happen immediately for people to notice any difference in the cost of housing by the time I get through my fourth year. We will have rapid introduction of the biggest crackdown on crime in Canadian history, a massive crackdown.
So yeah, those are his day one priorities. Axe the carbon tax, give money to the oil and gas industry, give money to developers, and crack down on crime.
Yeah, so we're going to cut revenues across multiple metrics, chasing an impossible utopian dream that number one, it will make life more affordable. Number two, it will mean more housing is created, which will then somehow translate into cheaper apartments. Both of these are utopian dreams that will never... Yeah,
pejorative utopian dreams. They're utopian dreams that could never be, that don't make any sense.
So he's going to be chasing these impossible things.
Yeah, like, what is more of a pejorative utopian dream than the idea that we can just keep going with oil and gas, and not convert the energy sector over to renewables. Like, it's just, there's a fundamental resource reality of the world that, like, oil is getting more and more expensive, more and more rare. I understand we have a lot of it here in Canada. I don't think anyone has suggested that, like, Canada completely cease drilling oil immediately or anything. But in terms of, you know...
Yeah, the typical, the most radical argument that's advanced is typically no new oil and gas wells, not shut down immediately existing oil and gas wells. And then that is totally, it's like roundly rejected by all parties, no new oil and gas.
And then the reality of climate change and carbon emissions. So there's this utopian dream that we can just keep pumping as much carbon as we want into the atmosphere, keep drilling as much oil as we want, and that will somehow lead us to a better green future. They even say at one point that that will be what powers the green future or something. I don't think I made that clip, but it was a weird one. But
yeah, no, there's some like techno-utopianism around it where they're saying like, we're going to use nuclear, we're going to use these different things, but we need to develop Canadian oil and gas so we can, because Canadian oil and gas extraction is less energy intensive than other places. So it like creates this net.
And also, like, if we have a whole bunch of energy, then we'll all be much more wealthy and there will be like more innovation and stuff. I think that was also kind of part of the what was being implied there.
Yeah. Non sequiturs.
Yeah, totally.
It does not follow. I'm using Latin. It's non sequitur is Latin for it does not follow, which would be like, for example, I like your shirt, so we should cut the carbon tax. It's that they do not connect to each other. It does not follow from the first part.
Yeah. And Jordan Peterson throughout this whole thing seems to have a weird like obsession with climate change stuff. Like he brings it up a lot.
No,
like,
he's a hardcore climate denier now.
Go on a nice road trip that the kids will remember when they're 85 years old.
Despite producing all that nasty carbon dioxide.
That's right.
The UK had 14 straight years of conservative government, but they fell 100% prey to the blandishments of the net zero types and brought forward really a catastrophic energy policy. And the UK is suffering dreadfully for that. And there's been a real conservative swing, especially among young men. Well, no wonder, because they've been demonized for, 30 straight years for every aspect of their masculinity, from their play preferences to their proclivity to destroy the planet with their ambition.
Yeah, so he's like, he keeps hammering on this thing. And at first I thought it was like a weird non sequitur thing, or I mean, it still kind of is, but yeah, it's clearly in line with Polyev's priorities, which is like drilling a bunch of oil and selling a bunch of natural gas, creating pipelines, doubling down on the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, and if we want to talk about elites influencing things, so one of the things that they allude to, like these political elites and stuff, the hypocrites, the grandiose narcissists, like the reason they pretend to be left-wing is because they're narcissists. But we're talking about real elites. This is being broadcast on the Daily Wire. The Daily Wire is a network that in great part is funded by fracking billionaires. Daily Wire has a political perspective in favor of oil and gas exploration, in favor of the burning of more carbon, putting more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, because that is demanded of them by their funders. They're getting billions of dollars from oil and gas money to fund this platform.
Yeah.
So Jordan Peterson being in this headspace where all sorts of environmental advocacy of any kind, even of like the half-baked marketeer kind, like carbon taxes and so on, is this ultimate horrific, narcissistic, hypocritical evil. And that we, by unleashing oil and gas, we will achieve the desired climate future anyways. Whether he consciously or whether he knows this consciously or not, and you don't know with the guy, he's out, he's clearly needs to be taken care of. He
by like a nurse in a care home kind of situation, not like, it almost sounds like you're advocating a Luigi.
Anytime I say someone needs to be taken care of, I'm talking about by a nurse in a care home.
Yes.
I think all the CEOs should be taken care of by a nurse in a care home.
Yeah, no, I'm not against it, honestly.
So there's that thread there too. And also just about carbon tax broadly. In terms of climate policy, there was a study that came out recently that in terms of the climate policies that have been pursued around the world, carbon taxes are among the most effective policies that have actually been implemented in terms of limiting expansion of carbon dioxide and so on. It's like relative to alternatives, places with carbon taxes increase their amount of emissions less. So increasing your emissions less isn't enough to avoid the planet burning. In fact, we're still hurtling on a trajectory towards total planet burning, TPB.
Yeah. We want to get to decreasing emissions, actually.
Yeah. So in order to do that, you need to have higher carbon taxes, which people will feel more in their day-to-day lives, or you need to pursue an alternate strategy.
Yeah.
The current level of carbon tax that we have with the increasing and stuff has positive effects, but because it's so embedded in the logic of the market, it's never going to be able to achieve what's needed. So just to make clear what our critique of carbon tax is, but why at the same time, I think I'd prefer to keep it.
Yeah, no, totally.
Also, yeah. I just want to talk about the my epic. I need to do my epic proposal.
It's gonna iconic. On day one. We're gonna get rid of the carbon tax. This is an epic. What was the other word you used?
Iconic.
Iconic. Did you use that word to describe your own policies, especially when the policy is getting rid of the carbon tax? Is like, yeah, that's like so ridiculous. Like,
and I want to say also for all of you electoral heads out there and all of you aspiring prime minister applicants for the future years, part of what Pierre is saying here, the logic behind what he's saying is true. That in order to give people hope to put in a progressive left-wing platform in practice, parties need to. And this is something that liberals under Trudeau at the start did well under, and something that I think the NDP under Horgan did well in 2017. But the core to the success of a program and reputation after taking office is you do need to have iconic promises that are doable fast, something that you can associate with yourself.
Weed legalization in 2015 was, I think, an actual epic and iconic policy proposal. Like, again, not a huge Trudeau fan and like certain things, but in terms of epic and iconic, if you're talking about carbon tax elimination versus legalizing weed, like, it's not even close.
Yeah. And yeah, so that's a great example. And then when it came to Horgan in 2017, they promised to eliminate MSP premiums. So people in BC paid $30 a month for healthcare. And they did within like the first year, they made it that you didn't have to pay that anymore. And they transitioned it to an employer payroll tax, it's called, where basically employers above a certain size pay this tax that covers the cost of healthcare, which is what's done in other provinces.
Yeah, that was great. Not having to pay MSP anymore.
Yeah. Honestly, yeah. They're still coasting on the goodwill of that, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And there's other similar things. But the general premise in electoral politics that you need trademark, iconic promises that people can see how it connects to their lives, and then you need to deliver them quickly. So at the beginning of your term, people recognize that you're serious. It's almost like he's repeating internal strategic discussions. Like, he's comfortable enough with Peterson that he's talking. It's not message box, is my interpretation of this.
Yeah, I don't think anyone told him to refer to his own policy as epic and iconic. It's just, it comes off as desperate and like,
yeah, loser.
Yeah,
loser shit. It's not, it doesn't crush the interview. If I was giving him the debrief afterwards, I'd be like, you mentioned it was epic and iconic, we talked about that.
I like the implication that, yeah, it's been this thing where he's like keeps saying it and they're like, no, Pierre, but you can't.
That's just what we, like, that was our
we
advice.
We believe that, but that's not messaging. We want other people to say that about it, although they probably won't because it's a repealing a carbon tax, which again, like, just doesn't have that epic vibe.
And the thing that's going to bite him about it is that it's not going to work. Like, you can keep a promise, but the implication, people aren't like, yay, axe the carbon tax in general for the purposes of there being no carbon tax in general. I don't care.
No, it's because they think their gas is going to suddenly cost half as much money, and it's not.
Yeah, it might. So my prediction is that when they cut the carbon tax, the oil and gas industry, they are going to temporarily lower their profit margins when that happens for the purposes of increasing the impact. When people are filling up their cars, they're going to feel that gas is cheaper. But part of that is going to be them taking a temporary loss on profits for the purposes of
doing PR for the conservative
party. Exactly. Yeah, and doing PR for the idea that carbon tax can't come back. But then it's going to trickle up, and it might be 3 years, it might be 4 years, it might be 5 years, but it's going to get higher than it ever was after that.
Yeah, like the price of oil is going to continue to rise indefinitely because the price of everything continues to rise indefinitely, and because oil reserves on the planet are getting smaller and smaller. Gas is going to keep getting more expensive. That's just how it works.
Like, yeah, so after he axes the tax, under the Pierre regime, you're going to be paying more than you ever were in gas. The difference is that instead of a chunk of that going towards giving you money and paying for environmental programs, it's all going to go to the profits of the pieces of shit at the top.
The balance sheet of the oil and gas industry.
The economic elite.
Yeah. So, yeah, before we wrap this episode up, I really wanted to play some clips of old Pierre, because we've been playing new Pierre. We've been saying, here's the media-trained Pierre talking about the common people.
Glamorous, fancy, glow-up, new Pierre.
Like, yeah.
Message-tested. He's been... He's been brought in a chamber and everyone's putting makeup on his face and he's got
the Botox. He's got the
injecting
work done.
His body with things.
He's looking good, honestly.
He's banging his head against the wall. Don't say epic. Don't say iconic. fuck.
But when you're watching this interview on YouTube, you just look at the recommended vids just below and you see, oh, there's another Jordan Peterson interview with Pierre from just 2.5 years ago. And the thumbnail, the Pierre in that thumbnail, just, he looks different.
The shape of his face is subtly different. He looks more bloated. He's wearing these big glasses, the glasses that a nerd would wear. Not a cool nerd that you'd play D&D with, but a mean nerd. The type of nerd that when spited would consider doing a school shooting, that kind of nerd.
As you click on the interview and the little sizzle reel at the beginning, even that, there's such a difference in how the two Pierres come across. Yeah, so I got a few clips here from the other interview, and I think it's instructive, and we should play a little bit.
We're going to talk more about old Pierre in the second part of this episode, for sure. But we want to make sure that this core part of his lore that we discovered from this interview is so critical to understanding the likely next prime minister of Canada.
I'm here simply restoring what already belonged to Canadians. By virtue of their 800-year inheritance of English liberties going back to the Magna Carta.
And what were you like in high school?
Well, I was a scrappy kid who loved sports, and then I got a terrible tendonitis in my shoulder, which made it impossible for me to do any amateur wrestling or football or any other sports that I enjoyed. So I'd get home from school and be bored out of my skull. My mom used to go and attend progressive conservative meetings. And so I said, why don't you take me to one of these meetings? Because I've got nothing to do. And she took me and I fell in love with it. And I just started reading books.
So were you a popular kid in high school, would you say?
Off and on. There were times when I was interested in hanging out and being part of the club. But there were other times where I just didn't care. Once I got involved in politics, I couldn't care less about the social life at high school anymore.
Mm. How old were you when that transition took place? You said that
16.
Was also a 16.
Yeah, 16, 17. Like I said, I kind of wasn't able to do any more sports. And so I said, you know, I'm going to go do something else. And once I took that part of my life took off.
You didn't look
the
back.
Social life. No, and I had like a lot, you know, my early teens, I loved hanging out with my friends and playing sports and stuff. But once I found a new passion, I became more focused on that.
So this, you know, modern polished Pierre would not be allowed to say this stuff on multiple levels. In particular, when I was watching this and when he's like, you need to take me to one of these meetings.
Why don't you take me to one of these meetings? Because I've got nothing to do.
Yeah. You can just imagine this 16-year-old kid who just like, mom, I'm bored. Take me to a conservative meeting. And then he gets there and he like sees the power of it because he is... Like, I'm just going to say, this guy's a freak. This guy's a, he is.
It also really shows the difference in how Jordan Peterson is interviewing him. And the new one, he's teeing him up on all these things. Like, how are you going to help the Canadian people? Or what can people expect on day one? But in this one, he's like, were you a popular kid in high school?
Yeah, it's a great question. It actually, my compliments to the interviewer there. And his answer, I think, speaks volumes. Because
he's like, I could have, like, there were times when I wanted to hang out with the people. But once I got into all this politics stuff, And we were going back and listening. I think, yeah, he says, I didn't need a social life.
Yeah, they both speak at the same time. Jordan Peterson says, you didn't look back. And he kind of mumbles it out. Like, once I got into politics, I didn't need the social life.
Once that part of my life took off,
you didn't look back.
Social life.
Which, okay. So first of all, just to clarify, being a popular kid in school doesn't matter. We're not here to say that every politician needs to be popular in school.
Of course not. No.
But what's interesting is, I guess you could say, the hypocrisy of it, in that he's putting himself forward as one way when it's clear and obvious and dripping through his response the reality of the situation.
Yeah, like, no, I mean, to me, if someone, like, you could just be like, oh, no, I was like more of like the political nerd kind of kid, or I was interested in it. Like, that's totally fine.
Yeah, but instead but, like, he's like, I didn't care about that.
Yeah, he's signaling this Sigma male, but like not.
Yeah, Sigma.
But like, yeah, saying like, you can't just say, no, I wasn't a popular kid. He has to say, well, I could have been, but I chose not to be.
Which also reinforces this vision I have of 14-year-old chubby, swollen face Pierre, big glasses, being like, Mom, I'm bored out of my skull. You got to bring me one of these meetings. I have nothing to do.
Why don't you take me to one of these meetings? Because I've got nothing to do.
Yeah, he's framing it as like, he, up until that point, he'd been like fairly popular kid or whatever, but he just decided at 16,
he had this tendonitis.
It was time. I'm going to stop doing sports, which, like, you don't have to do sports to be a popular kid.
Now, I tend to have pretty good intuitions on this stuff. And my intuition is that when he is saying, I'm bored out of my skull, you need to bring me to this meeting because I have nothing to do, he's channeling. He's not just telling this story. He's channeling the energy of him in that moment as a 15 or 16-year-old talking to his own mother.
Why don't you take me to one of these meetings? Because I've got nothing to do.
Just listen to the way that he talked there. And imagine he's talking to his mother as a 15-year-old. Because that is Pierre's unvarnished true character. I'm not saying this to attack him. I'm aware of the fact it attacks him. But I'm saying this because, like, when I saw that, I was like, this is the most revealing clip I've ever seen of this guy. It's like, it shows who he is. And the rumor is, what people talk about him, is that he remains a bully to this day, to other people in caucus, to other politicians and so on, that he talks disrespectfully to everyone around him, including his own team. He talks like that. That is the person he is. And being bored at 15, chastising his own mother for the fact that he has an injury and he's bored.
Yeah, instead of just being like, hey, Mom, like, I'm interested in politics. You're always going to those progressive conservative meetings. Why not take me along? Like, that could have been how he phrased it, but he was more like...
Yeah, even if he,
like,
actually was a little twerp piece of shit, he could... Yeah.
He could have mentally projected that back to him being this chipper, interested political kid at 16.
But instead, he can't help it.
He's like, Mom!
Yeah, bored out of my skull. And it's like, that is a bored out of my skull. It's like, and this is in the 90s.
Sounds like a 15-year-old.
It sounds like a real 15-year-old talk. And that's why he's channeling. He's like channeling the emotional experience of that moment,
right?
And we're seeing this unvarnished picture. I get such a vivid vision from this of the 15-year-old proto-conservative being shitty to his mom, and that is his character, I think.
Yeah, so there is more clips from this interview that we want to talk about, but that's all the time that we have for this week's episode. So we are going to be coming back with another one right away, the next episode, doing more of these clips, because there's like, yeah, I don't know. I don't want to spoil it. No spoilers, but there's some pretty wacky stuff in the second part. We now go to suburban Canada in 1985.
Mom, Dad, I'm bored out of my skull. I've got nothing to do.
That's not true. There's lots of stuff you can do. Why don't you go out and play with your little friends?
You know I don't care about that stuff. I could be popular, but I don't want to be. And ever since my injury, I can't play sports anymore.
Yeah, right. I mean, about that injury, I've been meaning to bring this up.
Just let it go, okay? Yes, son, your real injury is why you don't play sports. We believe you. I want to go on the adventure of my life. To go into the wilderness. To be responsible.
The adventure of a lifetime, eh? I got an idea. Son, what would you say if you, your mother, and I drove for a really long time? That's right, a road trip. We can fill up the car with leaded gasoline and tour our country's fine oil processing infrastructure. We can visit the tar sands extraction sites, oil refinery plants. We can make a game of counting the pipelines on the highway as we pass. It'll be a real carbon-based road trip. What do you say?
Wow! Dad? Mom? Could we really go on a road trip? Isn't a road trip a little bit grandiose?
A simple, earthy, carbon-based road trip with your family? That's the kind of grandiosity we can get behind.
Can we, Mom? Can we fill up the car with gasoline and then drive for a long time? Please? All right, let's do it. Family road trip.
Drive for a long time.
Yeah, drive for a long time.
Hey, kid, what would you say if I let you fill the tank at the gas pump?
Oh, could I? Is it okay if I get a little on my hand so we can smell it the whole drive?
Those are the fumes of freedom, son. I wouldn't have it any other way.
And like the common people that we were, me and my family did go on a wonderful road trip burning fossil fuels. My dad even let me get an extra canister of gasoline, just so I could pour it out the window as we drove. And when we got to a rest stop, I poured the gasoline in a fertile flower bed at spring's first bloom. I took my shovel and I stirred the gasoline, thanking nature for its bounty of gasoline. I even managed to get a little bit of my gasoline on a baby deer. We had so many plastic wrappers from all of our gas station snacks that the back of the car was absolutely full of plastic. It was amazing. But the thing that sticks with me the most, it wasn't pointing at the oil refineries and smiling. It wasn't imagining how many great pipelines we could get if we just got rid of some of these forests. It was a personal moment with me and my dad around the campfire. Trying to start the fire here so I can burn all these plastic wrappers.
Son, you don't need paper to get the logs going. Just dump some gasoline on it.
You're right, Dad. I was being woke. I'm sorry.
You know what? I was thinking... There we go. That's how you do it. I was thinking, son, you know, I've kind of been hoping that this trip might inspire you in some way to figure out what you want to do with your life.
I've been feeling inspired this whole trip, and I really think the real adventure of my life is going to be a career politician. Not so I can narcissistically and grandiosely pat myself on the back for how great I am by trying to help other people or trying to do good for the world.
You won't be spreading any blandishments of the net zero freaks, will you?
God, no, Dad. I'm totally against blandishments. Pull oil and gas out of the ground. Refine it. Send it across the country in bitumen pipelines. We need to unleash the power of the market and gut social programs so the sponges, you know, the unproductive sponges, are forced to work for the entrepreneurial.
Son, I could not be more proud. A father always hopes his son will grow up to be a sports player or maybe an entrepreneur. Those were maybe out of the question for you, but But as a third choice, being a career politician to serve the needs of those better men, the entrepreneurs, the big businessmen, you might need to glow up at some point. I don't mean to criticize a 16-year-old's appearance, but...
I know, Dad. I look like a weird little freak. A soulless little freak.
But if you sell out to these people hard enough, they will pay for that glow up for you. You'll be able to defeat socialism, defeat utopian wokeism. You'll be able to unleash the ambition of the men who are destroying our planet and truly, truly make Canada a place free for the non-sponges, free for the entrepreneurs, for the truly great men. You know, given who you are, it's the best I could hope for. And I'm so glad to hear you say that.
Thank you, Dad.
I'm proud of you. Because being honest, I always thought you were going to be a big loser, but this I can see.
I'll never forget that wonderful road trip with my family, even now, at the old age of 85. But that world is gone. Emperor Trudeau and the utopian wokists, they've taken it all. They brought in full communism, which of course means full poverty. They made it illegal to use any sort of energy unless you're a woke government bureaucrat. Their regulations are so strict it takes more than 100 years to start a business. Grandparents start the process of registering businesses in some futile hope their great-grandchildren will have a shot at being an entrepreneur. Adventure and ambition outlawed. Men have to sit down to pee. And they force us to kiss a picture of Trudeau every night and whisper to him he's beautiful, to reassure him that we still find him handsome and his ethics virtuous. It's all my fault. They told me to stop calling the ideas epic and iconic. They said when you say it about yourself, it sounds losery. Ugh, stupid, stupid Pierre. And that podcast, seriously wrong. All of their things they said about me, it stuck. I was in the top of the polls and it stuck. And I went careening down, down faster than the economy under a socialist government. And here I am, no hope left. Oh, my Botox appointment, amazing. Come in.
Chalif department, open up.
Hey, sorry, old man. We're here on behalf of the Trudeau Directorate.
We have received word via the brain chip we installed via vaccine that you were just positively remembering the before times. Is that correct?
Well, yes, my private thoughts. I...
What we're going to need from you is an affirmative out loud statement that you did not and will never look back fondly on the before times.
But it's not true. I have to be honest. I can't. I that's compelled speech.
Yeah, listen, old man. Compelled speech is the law of the land, okay?
Please do remember that the thought chip will know if you're being insincere.
But I can't. Say it and think it now.
Look, there's not a lot of things we punish for in this society. Obviously, murders running rampant, joining criminal street gangs is totally allowed. Thievery, robbery, open season.
To crack down on that would be an equity issue.
It would be unwoke, which is illegal now. But thinking the wrong things, believing the wrong things, and especially remembering the wrong times fondly is completely illegal. So this is your last chance, or you are going to be heavily tased immediately. It's the only thing we still punish for.
This is my last chance. My last stand.
I'm here for a Botox. Oh, wait, I'll just wait outside, actually. I didn't realize the police.
Please stay. This is my last stand. Will the old man stand up to the Emperor Trudeau regime? Will he be tased badly because he refuses to recant his fond memories of the olden days? Or will he submit to the tyrannical hand of wokest utopian international socialist big government? Tune in next time to Seriously Wrong to find out. Yeah, so this Pierre creep, Freaky Pierre, we call him, he wants to force everyone to upload their ID to porn sites.
Talk about this on mic, but yeah, he wants to do the age verification porn policy thing.
Yeah. And he, like, there's a whole raft of policies to discuss on why this guy's got awful ideas. But the heart of his politics is a deregulatory, unleash capitalism kind of agenda, cut social programs, and the version of himself he's putting forward to the Canadian people right now, currently high up in the polls, I think there's a chance we can bring him down. And I just, again, I want to emphasize, he's fake. He's pretending to be someone that he's not. He knows the impacts of his policy, by the way, too. That's another important thing. He's not an ideologue in the sense that he actually believes all these policies are going to help everyone. He's an ideologue in the sense that he wants to destroy centrist liberals because he believes they are secret communists or he believes that they're radically woke and so on. I think that part is genuine, but his belief that these policies are actually going to create benefits for people, I think, is not actually there. That's my read of it.
I think he genuinely believes that his policies are going to help the people that he believes are worth helping. Like, they said it directly in this thing. It's really bad to have an economy that punishes the hardworking entrepreneurial people. And the sponges, whatever, doesn't matter. They aren't sacrificing anyway. But so I think he believes it's going to help his rich buddies. But yeah, all that stuff about the grandiosity of common people and all that. Yeah, I think he knows it's not going to help them.
But we're going to talk more about this soon. Thanks for listening, everyone. Also, you want to hear more of us talking about Jordan Peterson in particular, we have that 3-part episode on Patreon. Donate $6 a month and get access to all the episodes. You can sign up, listen to the episodes and cancel it, or you can keep on donate and just keep listening and just, you know, keep listening to new episodes, new bonus episodes, and just, you know, keep supporting the show because that's where the show comes from. The donations that we get make this show possible. And thank you so much to everyone who's already donating from the bottom of our hearts. We can't thank you enough, really.
Yeah. You make it all possible. But yeah, thanks for listening, and we will see you all soon with more Peterson and Polyev.
The bromance that is actualizing hell on Earth on behalf of the oil and gas industry.